faith-filled finance. All major UK bank accounts. One app. Provision is built by Christians to help you steward what God's given you. Track your spending, saving and giving in one place. Join the waitlist now at provision.money and get your first month free. That's provision.money.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to The Profile. I'm Justin Briley, Senior Editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. And of course, the show is brought to you in association with that monthly title. So if you'd like a free sample copy, do go online and ask for one. premierchristianity.com/free sample. And every week here on The Profile, we're joined by Christians from some walk of faith and life to tell us about what they do. And, well, it's a pleasure to be joined by two people today on The Profile, somewhat unusual, but nonetheless very suitable today because they've co-authored a book together. I'm joined today by David Hutchings and Tom McLeish. David is a physics teacher. Tom McLeish is Professor of Physics at Durham University, also chairs the Royal Society's Education Committee. And their book is called Let There Be Science, Why God Loves Science and Science That Needs God, published by Lion. So both David and Tom, welcome along to The Profile.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with me. This is a show where we try and go back a bit, and we're going to do that with both of your stories as to what brought you to the present day and this particular book. So let's go back to the beginning for you, first of all, Tom. You're a Christian. You're a scientist.
Yeah.
Did those two always go hand in hand when you were growing up?
Well, they never conflicted. So I remember, so I've been a Christian since my early adult life, a scientist since, well, like I say, when I was about 2.5, I think, just fascinated by nature and exploring it. And I remember when I was a little boy, my grandmother, who's a very interesting lady, one of the first women to take a botany degree actually at London University, I think, gave me a little microscope and also showed me how to take photographs, you know, the old-fashioned way, real developer and
developing
fixer.
Things,
I remember doing this in the dark in her kitchen. And so influences like that. And interestingly, she was also a lay reader at the local Anglican parish church. So I had that example. Mm. It was only when in my, I guess, young adult life, I was launching a scientific career. I also had committed my life to God at that point, that people started asking me, well, how do I reconcile science and religion? And I didn't know where they were coming from because this had never really been a problem for me. I found out later, of course, what they had in mind.
I mean, we do live in an age today where many people and many key top scientists, you know, claim that there is this fundamental problem, this dichotomy between science and faith. Now, you weren't presented with that as an issue growing up. I mean, what were people saying when you did get to that point where they started to say that there is some kind of disconnect?
Right. So they say some strange things, like science has disproved God. We have that sort of there are memes going around. They say things there are historical stories that I found needed correcting, like the rise of science was a sort of secular movement that overthrew a Middle Ages, you know, caught up in Christian dogma and mysticism, when actually real history tells quite an opposite story. Historians today, like Peter Harrison, for example, Oxford historian of science now in Australia, has written very clearly pointing out how the early Christians took the philosophy of Francis Bacon, which is a Christian story of how experimental science is used to recover the sort of ignorance and damage to our knowledge of creation that is a result of our disobedience. You know, that's a bit of an interpretation of the Bible story of the fall, but it nonetheless shows that there's a strong Christian motivation to do modern science. The other thing people say is that is that religion is all about faith. In unprovable assertions, and that science is all about fact, on the other hand, and you can't mix faith and fact. So one of the reasons why I wanted to write about this was to tell real stories about science, where, if you like, faith with a small f, faith in the scientific ideas that you really believe in, but you know aren't very persuasive to most people yet, that sort of little faith is essential to how science works. It's a very human...
Yeah.
activity. Yeah. And it's also true that that a Christian worldview, the reason I'm a Christian, is partly scientifically motivated. I only have one brain, not two. And I'm a Christian because I found it the worldview that makes the best sense of the life that I live in, the world that I find myself in.
Yeah. Let's come to you, Dave. David Hutchings, you're the co-author of this book, Let There Be Science, with Tom. And in many ways, I suppose, what you've aimed to do with this book is provide a sort of an accessible, lay-level story of the history of science and how Christianity intersects at so many levels with it. And you do that, in a sense, you are communicating at an accessible level to students in your classroom
when it comes to
physics. Have you found that a lot of those who are coming through to do, say, A-level physics are coming with some kind of an idea that science and religion are in conflict?
Yeah, I think that it is almost the default position.
Wow. Mm. Okay.
It is so deeply ingrained, the idea that these are competing ways of explaining the world. Mm. You either explain it using science or you explain it using God, and then lumped in with God goes the tooth fairy and, joss sticks and scatter cushions.
Yeah.
or you can go science. And if you go science, then you can do an experiment and you can prove it. And there's maths, and that's what clever people do. Mm. This split, I think, it goes very deeply, and it goes very early as well. Certainly by the time I have students coming to me, the youngest I teach are 14, it's pretty much locked in. That viewpoint is locked in. Yeah.
Right. Mm. By the time they leave your care, do they potentially have a different way of viewing the relationship?
I think what I would hope is that they understand that this stuff is built on a very flimsy foundation. This view is built on a flimsy foundation. I had an email from a student who left this year saying, I haven't become a Christian, but you have shown me that becoming a Christian would not be something that I couldn't do.
Right, it's not an intellectually indefensible option, as it were.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, that's progress.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, take us back in your story then. Did you grow up yourself in a Christian family?
Yeah, I grew up in a Christian family. I think I grew up with an incredibly simplistic worldview. Mm. I thought that there were two types of people in the world. There were goodies and there were baddies. Mm. When they died, the goodies would go to heaven, the baddies would go to hell. And it was really easy to tell the difference because the goodies were the people that went to church on a Sunday and the baddies didn't. Now, nobody had taught me that, but I think
you
I just sort of picked it up. And then I remember very clearly being... I mean, I was quite a naughty little lad, and I can't believe that. I got into a fight. I got told off at school by the head teacher, and I can remember that whilst this guy was standing over me and pointing his finger and shouting, the thought that was going round and round in my head was, this guy just doesn't get that I'm a goodie. Honestly. So I came home with this sense of indignation, and I said to my mum, the head teacher told me off as if it was totally unacceptable that he'd done that. And she said to me, well, actually, sometimes you can be a pretty unpleasant guy. I can't remember the exact wording. But what I can remember is my entire worldview shattering as if it had been a snow globe over my head and suddenly it had fallen to pieces. I burst into tears, and for the first time I thought, what if I'm not a goodie? That thought never crossed my mind.
Right, yeah.
And in desperation, I said, what can I do? What can I do? And she said, you need to go to Jesus and ask him to forgive you. And you need to ask him for help to start running your life his way. Mm. So I did. Mm. So I was, 8 or 9 at the time.
Right.
And then I developed an interest in science. But I kind of did Christianity on my own. There were no other Christians at school to talk to about this stuff. There wasn't a youth group at church. My sister and I were the only teenagers really who were trying to live a Christian life.
Right.
And so I did it on my own. And I didn't really know what the done things were. I didn't fall into any kind of...
You didn't have a peer group to relate to.
No, that's right. No. And I think that it was in that context that at sixth form... my friends started to say, well, what about evolution, you know,
yeah.
And all this kind of stuff. And that's when the tension starts to come.
And how, you know, without really having anyone on hand to give you the answers, how did you go about trying to answer these questions?
I started to get books on apologetics.
Right.
So I was reading things like John Blanchard and stuff like that. But I think the problem there is I didn't know what was reliable and what wasn't. Right. So some of these books would be very solidly scholarly, and others would be fly by night. But I didn't know how you could tell the difference. Yeah. So I started building into my armoury some apologetic arguments that I now know are a load of rubbish.
Right.
So if any of my former sixth form colleagues are listening, some of that stuff I argued, I know now. I know it was wrong, but.
I mean, you were obviously learning yourself. That's right. This was all part of you coming to a mature faith where you were obviously grappling with the big questions that were being thrown at you. You'd obviously begun with something, I guess, that was an experience of God, something that obviously was very meaningful, but you were now having to try and make that, you know, work with the world you were being presented with. I think that's an experience many of us mm-hmm. go through mm-hmm. in that sense. Eventually, though, your science would lead you into teaching as well. So that's obviously something you've something of a passion for, communicating ideas and that kind of thing. And I guess for you, that's an interesting opportunity. You're not there as an RE teacher, but obviously those questions do come up, you know, in the natural course of things.
I'm famous with my students for spending almost no time on the actual topic. And
all the best teachers are like that.
Yeah. It's hard to tell exactly who's playing the game, really, but they know that they only need to ask some sort of question, and that lights the paper.
Drags the whole lesson off course.
But at the same time, I love that as well.
Most memorable lessons that I can remember from school are the ones where we completely went off at a tangent, you know.
And it often seems to come up in the space topic. That seems to be the one that triggers.
Yeah.
We're talking about space, and all of a sudden someone will say, well, we're really insignificant then, aren't we?
Mm.
Now, that question is a huge question.
Yeah.
Because Tom and I would look at the universe and draw the exact opposite conclusion.
Right.
You know, look at the scale of everything. So some people would say, it's so big that we're really small, so we're unimportant.
Yeah.
But I would flip it right the way around. And I think a really nice analogy is in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy, where there's this torture device called the Total Perspective Vortex. And the idea is it's the most horrific punishment or experience that anyone could undergo, because you walk into this room and you are shown the grand perspective of the entire universe.
Mm.
And when that happens, you're so overcome with your own insignificance that you're basically ripped to pieces.
Right.
And the hero of the book is
anti-hero. Say Fod Beeblebrox.
Yeah. Is frog marched in and comes out unscathed. And they can't figure it out.
He's got an ego this size of the universe.
But the key is, you know, why? Because it was all about him.
Right.
He goes in there and the whole universe is all about him. The thing that he picks up from this wow, look how big it is that just makes me worth even more.
Wow, right.
And I feel that when...
there are flaws to this now.
Well, you've got to let me finish it. The thing is that, you know, we live in this creation, this fantastic, giant, huge, astonishing creation, but it's for us.
Yep.
And God made it for us to live in and for us to have a relationship with him. And it is all about us, not in an egocentric way, but in an invitational way.
But coming back to you, Tom, the average atheist I know, who, you know, is familiar with these issues, would say that is an incredibly egocentric way of looking at the universe, because, you know, you look at us, we're on this pale blue dot, as Carl Sagan put it, we're, you know, just one scrap of life hanging on to, you know, in an overwhelmingly hostile universe when it comes to life. What on earth would make you think that we're the centre of it, or we're what this was here for? That's got to be a faith claim
on
your part.
Yeah, I would say, and I wouldn't say we're necessarily central. It is extraordinary that we are loved and created and cared for, and at the same time, God makes the distant galaxies and the universe. And actually, who knows What other parts of creation that there are? I mean, but this isn't as if this is new. I mean, I have, as you know, a deep love for the book of Job. They're right in the middle of our Bibles, possibly the oldest book there, maybe certainly one of the oldest bits of science, nature wisdom ever written. And there, right at the end, when God finally meets Job and answers some of his questions with a whole catalogue of beautiful questions about nature, he ends up going through all the chaotic, wild side of nature that Job knows about, the storms, the earthquakes, the lightning, and so forth, and the floods, and then the animal kingdom, and then goes off the end and carries on talking about beasts you've never heard of, the behemoth and the leviathan, and saying, you know, that's the beast, that's my creation which I'm most proud. And you're thinking, well, this is extraordinary. So actually, there's in Christianity, there is this extraordinary balance, I think, between...
It's not always about you.
It's not always about you. And don't claim it is about you. I've got other fish to fry. But you are, of course, I love you. And the leviathan thrashing about. So I think it's balanced. But it isn't about being insignificant.
Sure. True. It's fascinating stuff. I once saw a video, fascinating. I love science videos. And this one was one where it started with a human being. And then it zoomed out to see, you know, the planet they were on, and then the solar system they were part of, and then the Milky Way, and then, you know, right out to the limits of the observable universe. And then it went
and
then it went into the human, and it started to go down right to the subatomic, tiniest quark level.
That's right.
And the interesting thing is, if you're talking about how big are we? Well, we're kind of in the middle. That's a very good point.
In fact, Dave and I were doing a little day's discussion for some folk the other day on a retreat, and we actually built a diagram in scales of factors of 10, which does put us more or less right in there.
That's fascinating, isn't it? It is about perspective sometimes, isn't it? Talk us a little bit about this book then, because a lot of people will say, we don't need God anymore. We've got science. Science explains the way the universe is. God was there when we needed some kind of an explanation for why it rains and, you know, why earthquakes happen and so on. It was a ready explanation at the time for people who didn't know better in a pre-scientific age. And you talk about the book of Job, which, you know, is probably our oldest book in the Bible, very much written in a pre-scientific age. Yeah. And many people might wonder, why on earth would you think this is such a great book, you know, in today's world?
Well, one thing I wanted to say is that science, one of our problems with science is that science itself is rather needy. And so one of the sad things about this lie, really, this story that science is in conflict with faith, is that the church has tended to see science as a threat rather than a gift, and has run in the opposite direction, where it's actually what we need the church to do is to support science, accept it as a gift, support scientists as people with a calling, and help us wisely use the knowledge science gives us. You know, without the church doing this, society and politics even doesn't have, and certainly education, doesn't have the voice it needs, the voice of wisdom that it needs. And so something I say, you talk about this pre-scientific age, I'm not sure that what I've learned about the history of science really tells me that you can draw a line between scientific and pre-science. What I like to say these days is that science is the name that humankind gives the current chapter of a book we've been writing. It has previous chapters that go right back to the dawn of when humans first became humans. And, you know, just 100 years ago, 200 years ago, you see, I wouldn't be called a scientist, I'd be called a natural philosopher. And that's interesting, because that has a rather different ring to it. If science has a ring of I know things, then natural philosophy says, well, I love wisdom to do with nature. And sometimes I talk to people who have, for science is difficult and painful, and we're good at it. I said, well, suppose it were called love of wisdom to do with natural things. Would you find that more accessible, more inviting? And they say, yes, they would. And then, of course, that takes us right back to the wisdom literature of old. And you find that, you know, that there isn't a pre-scientific age. The great medieval thinkers in Europe who started thinking about optics medicine drew their information partly from their own minds and their Christian worldview, from the great Islamic philosophers and scientists of the early Middle Ages, who got it from Neoplatonism and the Greeks and the ancient Hebrews. So rarely, it's been a continuous story. Not to say science is part of what God how God makes us.
What kind of arguments do you make in the book, Dave, to say that we are in some way indebted to the Christian worldview when it comes to the way we do science today?
Well, each chapter looks at a slightly different element. So, for example, we have this view, Tom's talked about the book of Job, where Job's main charge against God, when he's dealing with, Job is suffering greatly, and Job is seeking to build a case against God. And he decides that the way to do it is to identify parts of nature where God is dropping the ball. And if he can do that, if he can show that God is making a mess of the natural world, then he's got a case, because he can say, you can't even look after the natural world, therefore, you know, you are morally making a mess of my life as well. So he starts to identify things, landslides, floods, whirlwinds, and so on. And in God's response, what we get is, no, these things appear chaotic to you, but they're not. And in fact, these are part of my plans. God says, you know, who is this that obscures my plans? And then he says, these things are watering lands that you don't know about. Mm-hmm. Okay, they are providing food for animals that you've never heard of. Basically, God says, I am running the world. And there is a big picture that all the small chaotic parts that you are saying I'm making a mess of actually combine to form. Mm. Well, that is something that we have learned in science is actually true at the most fundamental level of our existence. You go down to quantum mechanics, it is a seething, rambling mess. And if someone had just shown you that, you would say there is no way that there could be any kind of order in the world whatsoever. And therefore, I think it's no coincidence that many of the big players in the quantum revolution were Christians. And so you see this sort of scaling up. Mm. The Bible teaches us a truth about God and the world. We then discover it within the scientific context as well. And so we have other chapters, pain and suffering. We discover that in science. We discover it in the world. Love, we need it in science. A lot of early scientific ideas, when they're put forwards, are in bits and pieces. They are missing data. When Galileo argued for the Earth going around the sun, he had an awful lot of missing data. He couldn't build a very strong scientific case at all. But people loved that idea into existence. I mean, Robert Hooke, I think, says, there isn't really much going for heliocentrism other than the fact that it's really, really great. And so, again, we love these scientific ideas.
But because of where the conversation currently is in culture with people like Dawkins and others, kind of using people like Darwin as some sort of equivalent of poster boy for atheism, people are sometimes shocked to realise just how many Christians have been involved in scientific endeavour. I mean, do you want to give us some examples and the people that you talk about in the book?
Sure.
Yes, go ahead, Dave.
So Newton, I think he's a controversial figure. Some would say, yeah, definitely straight down the line, committed Christian. Others would say, well, a bit unorthodox on some fronts. But what is clearly true is he loved his Bible. Mm-hmm. He studied his Bible deeply. He wrote more Bible commentary than he wrote science in his life. And he believed in the God of the Bible. And then you have other people like Kepler, who explicitly says, you know, I'm doing this to learn more about God. Incidentally, he was right about a lot of the stuff that Galileo was wrong about at the same time.
Something else that Kepler says, we sometimes refer to Stephen Hawking, don't we, as the man who coined this idea of thinking, science being like thinking God's thoughts after him. Actually, it wasn't Hawking. Hawking was quoting Kepler. Well. Kepler says, gosh, if piety will allow me to say so, doing my science, it feels like thinking God's thoughts after him.
Who are some of your heroes in this regard?
Oh, well, I'm a massive fan of James Clerk Maxwell, actually. Well, two great 19th century, great experimentalist, a great, great theoretician, James Clerk Maxwell and Michael Faraday, both deeply committed Christian men. Faraday also committed to public outreach. So he sort of invented the, caused to flourish these great Friday evening discourses right here in London, the Royal Royal Institution. If you were anyone, you wore your glittery frocks and bow ties to the Royal Institution on a Friday night every week to hear what was great in science from Michael Faraday. When he'd done that, he'd take a left turn out of the building and go to the soup kitchen, because he was a member of a church, unusual church, doesn't exist anymore. It's a Christian church that had a passionate commitment to the poor of London. And he always saw that his science, he's the one who discovered really how electricity and magnetism are two sides of the cake, same coin, and work off each other. And then Maxwell, probably the greatest genius these islands have ever produced, apart from Newton, and maybe just as great, should be much better known, Scotsman, mathematically formulated the laws of electromagnetic fields and much besides, solids, liquids, gases, statistical mechanics. I use Maxwell's physics every day in what I do.
Well, I want to ask more about these people and how their science was undergirded by their faith in the next section of today's programme. But this is a fascinating topic, and we're talking today to the authors, the co-authors of the book Let There Be Science, Why God Loves Science and Science Needs God, here on The Profile. David Hutchings and Tom McLeish join me, Justin Brierley, for the programme. Again, if you want to listen back to today's show, you can do that online, premierchristianradio.com/theprofile. Available, of course, as a podcast as well. Do check it out on iTunes and however you get your podcasts. And we'll be back in a moment's time with the second part of today's programme.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme, The Profile, with me, Justin Brierley. I'm senior editor of Premier Christianity magazine. The Profile brought to you in association with that title. If you want to get a copy of the latest edition of the magazine absolutely free, you can ask for one at our website, premierchristianity.com/free sample. And it's always a pleasure to meet interesting people on the programme from week to week. In fact, I've got two interesting people joining me on the show today. They are Tom McLeish and David Hutchings. They've co-authored the book Let There Be Science, Why God Loves Science and Science Needs God. Available from Lion. You can find it at all good book retailers, online and everywhere else besides. Do go and check it out. It really is a very accessible book about the way Christianity has been the bedrock in many ways of scientific advances over the years. And we've been hearing your personal stories and your own faith in the course of today's programme, gentlemen. But we're getting into the meat of the book now. And you were saying before we went to a break, Tom, that, you know, people like Faraday and Maxwell have been some of your scientific heroes who joined their faith with their science. In fact, I mean, and with these people, who many people are maybe unfamiliar with just how many Christians have been involved in scientific progress and advancement over the years. I mean, many people like Dawkins might say, well, that was just incidental. They happened to be Christians who did good science, but in no way was their faith instrumental to that. You know, it was a bit of a, you know, one of those things. Why isn't that the case for you?
It doesn't hold up, because you can do the history, history properly. And I would point Richard Dawkins to another Oxford historian, Peter Harrison, actually now working in Queensland now, but who's written a proper document. You see, I wish Richard would do to history, take to history the quality he takes to his science, and actually make his statements evidence-based.
Yeah.
If you look at evidence-based, you can show that most of these scientists didn't live in a split, had split brain personalities or anything, but that their faith was motivating their science. So, if you like, science was their calling, and that's true for individuals, but it's also true for the great modern experimental science project as a whole. The founders of the Royal Society, Wren, Boyle, we've talked about Newton, ready, they were getting their philosophy. There was a very explicit philosophy of why we do science, and it comes from Francis Bacon. If you read Francis Bacon about it, and it comes from the a Christian understanding of what's wrong with the world. You know, mm. part of you know Christianity is great because it's realistic about the world being a rather painful and difficult place.
And not the way it and feels like it should
not
be.
Not the way it feels like it should be.
Yeah.
And it feels like it should be. In fact, it should be that we're kind of in peace and understanding with nature. And we're not, like Job was. And we find nature frightening, we're also ignorant of it. And these people realise that there's a Christian theology for using the minds God gives us and the senses he gives us and the curiosity he gives us to turn that into becoming, growing up really, from our sort of fallen state, growing up into a state where we are at peace with the world around us, where we can replace the ignorance that we have with knowledge and replace the fear and the sort of mutual harm of creation that we have with, well, let's call it wisdom. So now all that's a motive explicitly. It's all written down. People have diarized it. It's written in Francis Bacon's book, Novum Organum, as the basis for modern science. You can have evidence of that.
Yeah. I mean, coming back to you, Dave, I think where many people, we've already mentioned his name, Richard Dawkins, are coming from when they claim that there is this dichotomy between science and faith is they might look at modern incarnations of Christianity in certain parts of the world, young earth creationism, for instance, and they say these people are just trying to make the Bible say things about science that simply aren't true, and vice versa. And I think for them, that's where they see this great danger. They see that religious people are responsible for trying to undermine science, and they'll even read that back into history. And a typical example might be, you know, well, look back, and it's always been happening. Galileo was persecuted by the church for claiming the sun revolves, the earth revolves around the sun. And that kind of thing. And they say, this has always been the case. Religion's been a constant break on progress on science. Now we've finally had the Enlightenment at last. We can do away with superstitious thinking. It's time for science to take its proper place at last. So a lot there. But is that true? Is that whole story true? Even if you might be able to say, yeah, some of what you're seeing today is not necessarily a great example of the way faith and science matches up.
Yeah, that overarching story that is so popular is not true. So in the 1870s, there were two chaps, John William Draper and Andrew Dixon White. They both wrote books with very similar titles that take the basic form of a history of the warfare between the church and science throughout Christendom. You know, it's that kind of
slightly
massive,
loaded title.
Yeah, that's right. You know what it's going to be about.
Like and, reading a book called The God Delusion. Yeah. You know what's going to be inside.
That's right. But they sold like hotcakes. Right. And in fact, we're still being sort of revised and updated even into the 1950s, which is astonishing when you think about it. And that entire storyline where they sort of went back and tried to identify cases where the church had misled science, it's almost like you can go back one at a time and say, well, that one's not true. That one's not true. That one's not true. And so on. So you get these
myths.
You mean
they had taken examples and twisted them to their
own
narrative.
Some were twisted examples. Mm. Some were biased accounts of a very balanced and subtle story. Some were genuinely completely invented.
Fabricated.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Alternative facts.
Fake news has been around for a long
it's
time.
It's astonishing, really. Yeah. And for those two books to have the impact that they have, I almost see that as one of the evidences of the truth of Christianity, that Christianity says we're rebellious against Christianity. I think that means we're much more likely to bite when someone offers us a steak that's been laced with something that will turn us off Christianity.
Yeah. Talk to us about one of those classic examples. I mean, there's the whole Galileo, you know, being persecuted by the church for trying to do science.
So one of the useful things to say straight off, and I talk to the students about this, is I tell the original story, the story as it's well known, as it's generally presented, which is, hey, people, because the Bible says that the sun goes around the earth, everybody believed that, and if they didn't believe that, they were going to be in big trouble with the church. Then along comes a brave atheist scientist, Galileo, who says, no, I'm going to follow the evidence. And he proved mathematically and scientifically that the Earth goes around the sun. And then, because that was in disagreement with the Bible, the Catholic Church, and you can insert your own ending, it can be burnt him at the stake.
Excommunicated him.
You know, sent him off to Naboo or something. So, the thing is that if you look at each individual part of that story, they're all wrong.
Right.
So, for a start, the idea that the Earth went around the sun is an old idea. It goes back to the ancient Greeks. Mm. The reason it was rejected is there's no evidence for it.
Okay.
You know, when you
so
stand on the
it was always a theory that was on the table. It's just there had been not enough evidence to show that
that's
was true.
That's right, because if you're flying around the universe at these incredibly high speeds, then according to all the science of the day, your own atmosphere is blown away, so the Earth should have no atmosphere, and you should be flung off. Mm. The whole thing was patently ridiculous. So it was thrown out for scientific reasons, not because it says it in some psalm somewhere.
Right.
The second thing to know is that Galileo was a committed Christian, an incredibly committed Christian.
And stayed that way
his whole life, and wrote one of the strongest defences of Christianity in relation to science that's ever been written in 1615, a letter to a friend. And he turned his telescope up to the skies. He had a new type of telescope. He took some measurements. He started to become convinced that Copernicus's idea from a few decades earlier, that maybe the Earth was going around the sun, might just be right. Now, interestingly, we don't know whether Copernicus actually thought that himself. Copernicus writes down these ideas. He thinks, look, this is a neat mathematical solution. Isn't it useful? And no one in the Catholic Church reacts. Copernicus doesn't get into any kind of trouble. There's no kickoff whatsoever.
In fact, you should say the Pope at the time actually encouraged Copernicus to publish his book. That's the situation of the Church in the 14th.
That's right. Then Galileo comes along. He thinks, hey, Copernicus might have been onto something. He finds a few initial readings, and he starts advocating Copernicanism. Then that gets a few people's backs up, because Galileo is this belligerent character, this flamboyant character. He's loved by about half of the world and hated by the other half of the world. And so he's got enemies. And some people get him dragged along for a trial where he's asked to defend his position, and he can't. He puts forward a few scientific arguments, but not very many. It's mostly rhetoric. Mm. And he does it in a rather unwise way.
Right.
Winds a few more people up, and then he's banned from teaching it as a theory.
Mm.
He signs it. And Robert Bellarmine, who is the one of the inquisitors, in fact, was he the head of the Inquisition at the time? He was certainly a big hitter. He says, well, look, there are certain scriptures that appear to us to say that the Earth is still. But if Galileo can provide scientific evidence that it's moving, we need to admit that we've misunderstood these scriptures. Mm-hmm. Now, that's written down at the time.
Right.
Which is exactly what you would expect if you're doing good science. He then says, but there isn't enough scientific evidence, so we're rejecting it. Then Galileo's best friend is elected Pope. And he thinks, I'm onto a winner here, because this guy's always supported him. Mm. And so Galileo decides, you know what, I'm going to write this book, and I'm going to go full explicit. This is definitely the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So he writes it out. He takes it to the Pope, and the Pope says, well, I think you've been a bit too headstrong here. It needs to be gentler.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Pope takes this rather odd line of, these things are too mysterious.
Mm.
This is God's business. Mm. You shouldn't be prying into it. And that takes Galileo a bit by surprise. So the agreement is that he then has to present it as not a lock-solid theory, but one that is on the table.
A tentative theory.
He inserts a character into his book who he calls the Fool. And he has the Fool giving all the Pope's lines. And in the book,
not the most politically brilliant move.
Not a good move.
The other characters refer to this guy as a mental pygmy, and so basically, Galileo now has said to the Pope, you know, here's a personal insult that I want to go big with.
Right.
And the guys, they just fawn out,
right?
And the Pope was not a pleasant chap himself. There's this trial. They get Galileo on a technicality.
Mm-hmm.
Where they say, hang it, we found this signed document from before where you said you weren't going to teach this stuff and you've gone against it. They managed to get him on the smallest charge they can possibly get him on, and then he argues again in a rather unwise and unscientific way, gets himself in more trouble, they up the charge. Eventually, he is put under house arrest. He's not burned at the stake. He is not tortured. He's not put in prison. All these things are myths. And he is packed off to house arrest in a couple of different places. Lives for about another 40 years or something.
Continues to do the things he enjoys
doing. Continues
doing
his science, including writing his greatest work of all, which is the work on motion, which then in turn led to Newtonian physics. He's probably the best treated heretic in the entire history of the Catholic Church.
And in that sense, it's far more a story about personalities and politics.
It's a fascinating story. Yeah. Real soap opera.
Yeah, I mean, there are no good guys in it. Everybody got stuff wrong. And the church at the time was a brute beast often. People were being burned for heresy. But no scientist has ever been executed for their science in the entire history of the Christian Church.
That's an interesting one. I mean, I'm sure there's a few other myths you explode in the course of this book as well. Because, as I say, we do live in this era where there's this kind of narrative about science versus faith and so on. I mean, Tom, you've been trying to counter that narrative, you know, for as long as you've been working practically.
Yeah.
But what is it about, in general, do you see what Dave sees in his classroom in the scientific ranks, that generally there's this assumption that if you're a scientist, you're not a God-fearer? And is that borne out with the academics you work with, that they're surprised that you have a faith?
Well, I'm often asked this, actually, and I don't know whether you think it's good news or bad news, but I would say not so much. People always expect me to say, oh, yeah, I'm going to get terrible trouble in the Royal Society, or I get terrible trouble in my physics department. And actually, to be honest, I really don't. And it's not because I shut up and I stuff my faith in people's faces all the time, but I haven't been quiet about it exactly. Maybe people think I'm a bit odd. I'm not alone, so I can think of a good handful of committed Christians in my physics department. What the statistics show is that by and large, being a scientist or not being a scientist doesn't affect the likelihood, you know, for whatever reason, of being equal, that you're a believer or not. I wish I could tell you I'm going to persecute with an inch of my life, but I'm actually not. Universities, like all places, I mean, this question does pack the crowds in. So if we did at Durham last term, we had a Durham Physics Society debate where one of my colleagues, who's quite an outspoken atheist, he was debating against me and the Bishop of Durham. In fact, we actually got on to this. We thought it would be quite a small affair. We had to move the lecture theatre at the last minute because 300 people came or something, far more than we thought. Actually, I could have guessed. This question runs. But actually, I'm a bit ambivalent about this because people love fights. They love, the Romans. They love the Colosseum. They love the gladiatorial fight. And that was a bit of a gladiatorial fight. But what I'm trying to do, and what we were both trying to say in the book, and what I was trying to say in an earlier book called Faith and Wisdom in Science, was that actually we need to get beyond the fight because actually time is short and we need to drop this silly combative view and actually realise not just historically in the past is it important for the church to support its science, which it has, but it's going to be important in the future. And something that I say is look at every many of the important global questions that we're facing now, climate change, energy, things like fracking, human disease and development, genetic engineering and all those things. These are genetic engineered crops. These are really important questions. They're science-based questions. But the public debates about them, political debates, are characterised, to be honest, not by being very grown up, but by this combative gladiatorial, making prejudged opinions and then hurling anathemas at each other. And one of the reasons for that is, frankly, because the church has turned its back on its responsibility and run away from this. What I'm saying to Christians is that get behind, stop seeing science as a threat, see it as God's gift or a talent, not to bury in the ground, to take a New Testament parable. I'm sure that for many of us,
In the past, the church has been the talent that the wicked servant buried in the ground because he was frightened of the master, thinking it was not what he wanted him to use, when actually it was. When you get out there and be salt and light in the world, we're running a lovely project with Michael David Wilkinson, who's principal of St John's College Durham. You may have met him. And we're trying to work with senior Christian leaders, bishops if it comes to the Church of England, senior leaders in other churches, and getting them into the lab, meeting scientists, getting to realise that science is a calling and that their churches can help.
And the church is a friend of science.
Not
this sort of idea.
But one of the things that we would love is you typically have somewhere around about May, June in churches all over the country, you have the 17 or 18 year old who's been in the church the whole time. They're called up to the front, they give a little bit of testimony, and they're going to go off to the mission field somewhere, or they're going to go and do a theology degree, and hands are laid on and they're prayed for, and so on. Well, we would say it's as much a calling on someone's life to go and study biology or astrophysics as it is for them to go to the mission field and so on.
Let's pray for them.
Let's pray for them.
And so we get them up and we pray, and that there'll be a blessing in that area.
Yeah, and I think there are probably more, you know, scientists in our congregations than we often think there are, but they sort of keep a low profile. They don't talk about it because it's not considered as a spiritual kind of way of looking at the world or something.
And if you look at Solomon, He asks God for wisdom to rule the nations. It says in 1 Kings 4 that, so God gave Solomon all this wisdom. He was wiser than this guy, wiser than this guy, wiser than this guy. And everybody came to listen to him. And if you look at what it is that he talks about, it says he talks about birds, he talks about plants, he talks, So what's he doing? He's doing science, right? Well, like, what's he saying about plants? So that thousands of people would come and listen to it must be new revelations about nature,
right?
And so we see really early on, and Paul in Romans chapter 1, what can be known about God is made clear in the nature around us. And Paul's not writing in the context of a big atheism versus theism debate. He's writing in a theistic world. And so actually his claim is even deeper. He's saying, by looking at the world around us, you're not going to find out just whether there's a God or not. You're going to find out who that God is, what they're like. That really is significant.
That's an interesting claim. I mean, do you think the conversation is changing on this, Tom? Because, and I'll give you an example which you'll be very familiar with, which is your predecessor in your role at the Royal Society, Michael Rice. He kind of found himself at the centre of a controversy, not of his own making, but as someone who I think is ordained himself, his role at the time as you now hold, which is part of the education committee, chairing that for the Royal Society, was suddenly called out on this by Richard Dawkins, who likened it to being something from a Monty Python sketch, that you would have an ordained clergyman in charge of, education from the Royal Society. Now, Michael Rice, you know, I interviewed him about this, was incredibly gracious, as he is, about this whole episode.
Kind of absolutely gracious is the word.
But that kind of, and I don't know if you, maybe that wouldn't happen today, you know, it's not that long ago it happened, but do you feel things are getting beyond that kind of,
Well, I'm still actually looking forward to when Richard Dawkins calls it Monty Python-esque that an Anglican lay reader is now.
Because they seem to have committed the same error twice. Just
Jerry Coyne has said it.
Well, yeah, no, that's true. So Jerry Coyne, his blog, did
kind of the American version of Dawkins,
4 hours after publication of Let There Be Science, Jerry blogged about the book. It was the worst person you can be, if, according to Jerry Coyne, is an accommodationist, like a swear word. So we're accommodationists, so we're saying it sounds good to go together, which they do, which they always have. So Jerry, evidence. He said, "What the? Am I allowed to swear on this program? If someone else is, well, I'm not sure." Anyway, it's what the beep 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 he wrote is a Christian doing as the Royal Society Education Chair. So I had great fun writing at enormous length exactly what we are doing to help science teachers, to bolster kids with great science education, to broaden, you know, I answered his question precisely.
Did he get back to you?
Yeah, he said, well, okay, fair enough, thank you, I'm good, it's good you're doing all this stuff, but as long as faith doesn't enter it, no, this religion enters into it. Well, you know, okay, Jerry. But yeah, I think things are changing. That wasn't the Royal Society's greatest moment, and it was all a horrendous misunderstanding, actually. What Michael was trying to do is to
is to say that that schools are a good place to handle the creationist arguments, some of these anti-scientific arguments that kids are getting, perhaps in some churches or some places, and give them a space to work them through. He wasn't suggesting that this happened in science lessons, and it's true. I think that schools are not a place you should shut down the questions that kids have, but you should open them up and discuss them. And I think those are very important places, because there are certainly statements that some churches have made which are not biblical and of huge destruction to the gospel, and this insistence on 6-day creationism is one of those. It's one of those. It's doing huge amounts of damage to people, to the church, and to science. So I haven't got time to discuss that at great length now, but good for Mike for bringing that up. But I do think there's a change now. There's a project called Scientists in Congregations. In fact, you used the word. There's a project that we've involved in funding. Messy Church has got involved. There are all sorts of things. I was involved in three churches in East Leeds, a Baptist, a Methodist, Anglican church, just decided to launch a science festival. Because why not?
Yeah.
For their local community. Norwich Cathedral is going to have next year, you heard it first here on Premier Christian Radio, Dippy the Dinosaur is going to spend 6 weeks down the nave of Norwich Cathedral. All the services are going to happen around it. So the dinosaur's going on a national tour, and in the east of England it's going to land in Norwich Cathedral, and they're going to build all sorts of science events around that.
And the whole thing for you, and I guess the message from this book is that Christians, the church, faith have nothing to fear from science. On the contrary, they have worked together in harmony for so long, and we shouldn't buy into this narrative that they're somehow have been or are in conflict today.
No, it's
fascinating stuff, really. I just want to say thank you for creating a hugely helpful resource, I think. One that I think probably is going to be helpful for students as well, Dave. I think this is the kind of book that hopefully someone who's maybe at that A-level stage and wanting to start to look into these kinds of issues could pick up and use.
Yeah, I think it is aimed at someone who hasn't got any specialist advanced knowledge in either science or in Christianity. One of the most encouraging things to have happened for me is that there have been a couple of ladies who I would say are over the age of 65,
right,
who've bought it and read it, and one of them has now covered their wall in their office with printouts from Wikipedia of the planets and the periodic table and so on. And they said, you know, science is something that's passed me by completely my whole life.
Right.
But I've read this book and I thought, hey, there's this whole world that I don't know about, and this person is a Christian.
Right.
And I think that we're seeing this happen. People shut away from science because it's presented as essential, and suddenly they think, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And another lady who said, you know, I have tried to understand the scientific understanding of the universe and never got anywhere, but I read this book and all of a sudden it fits into place.
Great praise. We're out of time, I'm afraid, but it's been so much fun talking to you both. Tom McLeish and David Hutchings have been my guests on The Profile today here on Premier Christian Radio. If you want to listen back to the show, do go to the website premierchristianradio.com/theprofile or find it as a podcast on iTunes and other podcast providers. And don't forget to get hold of the book as well, Let There Be Science, published by Lion. And indeed, you can find more interviews, of course, with people from all walks of faith and life in the magazine, Premier Christianity Magazine, bringing you today's show, premierchristianity.com for more info. For the moment, time's beaten us, but David and Tom, it's been such a pleasure and all the very best. And I hope this book reaches many people and continues the conversation.
They're very kind. Thank you very much. We enjoyed it. Thank you, Justin.
You've been listening to The Profile with me, Justin Brierley. Coming up next, Dave Rose is here with Premier Playback.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto.
at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.